Again, continuing from the ideas of previous, but what I'm going to begin to doing today and try to work out a whole system for you is the understanding of the manifestations of hashkofa in psychology. In other words, the understanding of human behavior, or some of the understanding of human behavior, and how we really can understand it through hashkofa. Notice how we view mankind in terms of hashkofa principles. Now, we know so far that there are many things called psychological phenomena. There are many psychological phenomena. And of course, these psychological phenomena is why people do things as they do. So the idea, we also know that hashkofa is the underlying principles of the Bria. It's a design. It says why people are the way they are, why things happen the way they do, and so on. It's a design for everything. As such, obviously, hashkofa also must make a statement about the composition of man himself. Why a person is the way he is, behaviorally and psychologically. And of course, especially in that way, because if the tachlis of the Odom is to do a certain task, do mitzvahs and so on, to reach certain conclusions and so on, obviously, man himself must be shaped or designed both biologically and psychologically, exactly to enable him to do whatever the tachas habriya is, which is olam haba, right? So obviously hashkofa in its design must be able to answer also the psychological aspects of mankind himself. And today I'm going to make a small attempt in that direction. And as such, I'm going to try to explain certain psychological phenomena, number one. Also, I'm going to try to understand two different ideas. Now, the first idea is the idea of what is the fundamental psychological drive, or rather need, that people have. The psychological needs and drives. And I'll explain the difference between a need and a drive, and what's really meant. In other words, what is the fundamental need and drive that mankind, Adam, has? And if we understand that, why does he have it, and how does that help him accomplish what he has to accomplish? How do we see that emanate directly from hashkofa? Another question is, what about the psychological conflict? What is the major idea in terms of man's conflict in this world? How does that relate to the hashkofa ideas that have been proposed until now? And how does that emanate from the hashkofa yesodis? Now, I know most people here do not have a background in psychology. I know that. But I'm going to try to explain it in such a way where you won't need a background in psychology. I'm not going to make you an expert psychologist in that sense. But I'm going to try to give you a certain introduction in certain ideas of psychology. And that will be enough of an introduction to proceed. Now, when we analyze psychological drives, psychological conflicts, and also the phenomena and how they all relate to hashkofa, we must understand first one sort of little structure. And this we had gone to previously. Every person has a sense of self. Every person is aware of itself as an independent being, okay? It's the first idea. There's a sense of self that every person has. In other words, the person himself is aware, which is an act, of himself. He reflects upon himself and he realizes that he himself is an independent being. In addition, the individual is aware of the fact that it strives, that it does, and the strivings, of course, is in Machshava Dibun Maitzah. Man thinks, man talks, and man does, acts. That's how man strives. So therefore, a person is aware not only of himself as a being, but the fact that he strives. He's also aware that he has a will, that he wants, he desires. And the strivings is in consequence or in response to his will, what he wants or desires. The will is a faculty of man. In addition, what is the content of the will? What do you want to desire? So therefore we can distinguish between what a person desires, the will, rather the act of willing or desiring, and what is that desire? What do you want? The content of the will. So we have the person, the self, we have the fact that he is aware that he strives, and that his strivings are in response to the faculty of will, that he wills, wishes, desires, or wants, and that what he wants has specific content. What do you want? And therefore, that's what you're striving. This is what a person is aware of. Now, what I'm going to try to do is analyze, basically, the understanding of what the content of the will is, the motive. Motivation in human behavior is one of the most important ideas to analyze, because all human behavior comes out of some aspect of motivation. You always do something because you want something. You don't do something for nothing. There's always an aspect of motive, whether you are aware of the motive, conscious, or whether you are not aware of the motive, unconscious. It doesn't make a difference. There must be some motive preceding the striving, because that's the way man operates. There's an I, a self, that wills, and in consequence to what the person wills, which is the content, the person strives. So the content of the will is always there, whether it be conscious or unconscious. This is so far the fundamental ideas that one must understand, and what I want to do in this shiur. Next, let's take a look at motive. What motivates people? Motive can be looked on in two different ways. First of all, there are biological motives and psychological motives, right? Also, there are motives. Motives can be subdivided into two areas. There are needs and there are drives. What is a need? A need is a deficit, a deficiency of something. Whatever it is, doesn't make a difference. It's a chassan of something. That's the need. Every need, as a result of the fact that it has a need, has a drive. In other words, something makes you get up and fulfill that need. A drive is nothing more than a mechanism which activates or mobilizes you to fulfill the need. For instance, we all have a need of food, right? What is the drive that makes us go up and go and get something to eat? Hunger, right? We have a need for drink, liquid. What makes us go and drink? Thirst. Hunger and thirst are two drives in response to two needs, food and water, right? Now, the idea is, so we see that there are two things, the need itself and the drive which comes in response to the need. And the drive is called an activating mechanism, a mobilizing mechanism, because it forces you to go and get up and do or fulfill the need. Okay? So in every motivation, there's always need and drive. And the drive forces you to fulfill need. Of course, the Rebbe Nishan created the aspect of drive, because if you didn't have a drive, you wouldn't get up and do anything about it. Drive makes you aware of the need, and it forces you to fulfill the need. This is the idea of drive. Drive is a necessary component in motivation. Besides need, you need the drive also. Okay? So we now see that there are needs and drives, and this comprises motivation. Now, let's take a look. There are two kinds of motivations, biological and psychological. What are some of the biological needs, and therefore drives? Right? Well, I mentioned food, water, there's a need for oxygen, a need for sleep, right? Therefore, they all have drives. They force you to go and fulfill these needs. Also among the needs is the need for preservation of species, and that manifests itself into a sexual drive. That's all part of it, because the Rebbe wants mankind to populate the earth. They obviously, therefore, he gave them a drive. So these are the biological needs, which comprise one area of psychological motivation. What are some of the psychological needs and drives? Let's take a look at some of the psychological needs. And in the psychological needs is what I want to investigate. We begin to see how Hashkofa begins to emanate. I'm going to mention there are many psychological needs, okay? I'm not going to mention all of them, it's not a course in psychology, but I want to mention several of them, which are very fundamental and usually most confusing to most people. Even to psychologists, they're confusing, as you'll see. So I want to mention them and then begin to show you how they integrate with Hashkofot. There's a psychological need called adequacy. Everybody wants to feel adequate. If you do not feel adequate, what do you really feel? Inadequate, right? So there's a certain thing called the need for adequacy. What does the need for adequacy mean? Well, adequate means competent. When you feel adequate, it means you feel competent. So what we really say is that everybody has a need to feel adequate. He has a need to feel competent about what? About his ability to cope with life. When you go out and you work and you bring home a good paycheck, you feel you have a strong sense of adequacy. Because that proves to you, you can go out and conduct the business of life, which means staying alive and not dying, fulfilling your needs and so on. So in other words, the competency that you feel when you actually are able to have a good life, you succeed in living in a good way, is called adequacy or competency. So therefore, all people have this need for adequacy, which is very important. And when you do not have that need for adequacy, for instance, if you keep getting fired all the time, right, what do you begin to feel? Inadequate. What do you mean inadequate? You feel that you feel you're not competent to live or go about the job of life. You're not making it. If you keep getting fired from a job, if you have no friends and you never can make friends, okay? If you're married and you get divorced, and you get divorced several times, or whatever, any kind of situation that life demands. If you are not making it, you feel inadequate, which means that you feel incompetent. You cannot go about doing the business of life. Okay? So therefore, people have a need for a psychological feeling of adequacy. Now, one can understand very simply, why do we have to feel adequate? Well, obviously, adequacy makes sure that we will strive to be competent. And we have to be competent in living. So the Vaishnava will give us a drive of adequacy. Because if you feel that you're inadequate, then you're going to make sure you're going to feel adequate, right? So you're going to make sure you become competent. You'll try to hold the job or whatever. So therefore we understand what adequacy is. We understand why a person has needs of adequacy. To motivate him, to get him, to drive him to go and become adequate and competent in making a living and so on. Now, obviously adequacy, when you feel inadequate, you feel that you're incompetent. You feel a lot of anxiety as a result. Why? Why should I feel so bad because I feel inadequate? The answer to that is if you are inadequate, what does it mean? If you are incompetent to really go about living. And what that really means is that you're not going to fulfill needs. And what that really means is that if you don't fulfill the needs, what's going to happen to you? You're going to die. So at the bottom of the feelings of adequacy is the fear, of course, of death. So therefore, the bottommost rung of the feelings of adequacy is what's called a self-preservation instinct. Every human being, every living thing, has in it what's called a self-preservation instinct. They want to live. They want to continue to live. In fact, there's no such thing as suicide among animals. Unless it's an instinct like the lemmings. Okay? Suicide by an animal does not exist because of the self-preservation instinct. An animal doesn't decide to commit suicide. There must be some instinctual beyond their control. Like the lemmings. After, I think, every once in a while, a couple of years, they all jump into the sea. So instinctually they must commit suicide. But animals don't commit suicide unless they must be forced. Only human beings have the will or the volition to commit suicide. Okay? And that, of course, goes against self-preservation. So therefore, the self-preservation instinct that forces us to be afraid of death is what forces us to want to be adequate. Therefore, inadequacy, the feelings of inadequacy, is very threatening. Because the conclusion is that you're not going to make it. So therefore, we strive to become competent. See? That's an analysis of a fundamental psychological need, what the need is, the rationale for the need, how it's connected to other needs, and so on. Okay, that's one need. Let's take a look at another need, besides adequacy. There's another need called security. Everybody has a need for security. And we know if you do not feel secure, you feel insecure. And many people confuse insecurity with inadequacy. They'll call you, well, I feel inadequate or insecure these days, you know? But they're different. They're different. The need for security is not the same as a need for adequacy, although it's similar. Security is a need which means that because you have to fulfill a lot of needs, right? So what you're going to try to do, in other words, in order to live, there's many conditions that you must fulfill, right? So what you try to do is create a certain circumstance or environment which will always give you the right needs. So it makes you feel secure. Secure meaning that that environment that you've set up to always fulfill your needs is going to be there. Okay? What happens if all of a sudden that environment becomes destroyed? Then you feel what's called insecure. What's a good example? For instance, and you'll see many social institutions that arise out of the need of security. People want to save money, right? And they put it into a bank. Why do they do it? Where does the need to save money come from? One of the needs is security. Because as long as I have money in the bank, a person will say even if he loses his job, he has from where to take money to keep living. That's why people save. It's a need for security. Okay? And you are insecure, let's say if you lose all your money in the stock market. You go all of a sudden, that cushion that could keep you going if you lost your job or some other means of livelihood is not there. So you feel what's called insecure. There are many social institutions that arise from the need for security. You know what they are? Social security. It's even called security. Why? When you get old, right, and you can't work anymore, you're afraid that that whole system you set up to try to feed you is now flop, right? Because you can't work anymore. So therefore, social security means it's a security for society. That when they get old and they cannot work, they will be able to meet their needs in a consistent framework, right? What's another example? Seniority, like jobs with tenure. Why is there jobs with tenure? To make sure you don't get fired. So also tenure in colleges, seniority on businesses, all of these things are in order to make sure that your needs for security are fulfilled, that you don't feel insecure. You know, it's another popular form of security, insurance. If somebody gets sick or somebody dies, right, you won't be out in the cold. Again, whole social institutions have established themselves on people's needs for security, to make sure that there's a consistent form of developing needs, even though other forms will have disappeared. That's the need of security, and if you don't do that, you are obviously insecure. Now, why is there a need for security? Again, because if you're not secure, you won't fulfill needs, and if you don't fulfill needs, you will die. Again, it arises from the self-preservation instinct. You see? Because a person wants to keep living, therefore he wants to make sure that the conditions he set up for giving him the needs, whatever he needs, will remain consistent. That's security. Okay, so we've analyzed insecurity and we've analyzed inadequacy. What are the needs? I'll go through two more needs and that's it, then I'll stop. There's a need by everybody for acceptance and approval by others. Right? What's the difference between acceptance and approval? I said two things. Well, there's a need to be accepted by others. That's called belonging. Every person wants to belong to a group. Man is what's called the gregarious creature. It means people like to live together. They don't want to live alone. There are animals which are gregarious. The wolves go in packs. Bees go together. There are many animals that live alone. They don't have social structures. They only have individuals, they have family units, and even that doesn't last very long. But man is a gregarious being, he lives in societies together. Why? Because people have a need, there are many economic reasons, because obviously you can't do everything, so therefore you have to live together, everybody will do something else, and everybody will keep living that way. But the need for acceptance means the need to belong to a society, and then the need for approval. It means not only do I want to belong to a society, I want everybody to think I'm important in that society. That's approval. Another word for approval is called status. Right? Status. It's not enough to live in Borough Park and be accepted as part of Borough Park. I want to be considered an important member of Borough Park. Therefore, I will buy chandeliers, I'm saying this facetiously, and I will have rock gardens and marble fronts and so on. This makes me an important member of Borough Park. Okay? This is status. So people strive not just for acceptance, to get into the club. They want to be the top of the club. They want to be approval. This is what the popular expression, keeping up with the Joneses. This is half the behaviors in America results from acceptance and approval by others. The social clubs and, I mean, there's so many things. It's incredible that this need to be accepted and approved, status-wise, how that affects human behavior. Okay. Again, but why should a person have this need? What's a rationale? Because people have to want to live together. There are several reasons, but one reason we can easily see is that since I cannot fulfill everything myself, therefore it's very important for me to be accepted and approved by other people so that they give me things that I don't have in order to keep going. Because, I mean, not everybody can be a farmer and a butcher all at the same time. Somebody's got to grow, somebody's got to sell it, somebody's got to shoemaker, somebody's got to make things. Everybody's got to do something different. There's just too many things to do. So therefore, you want to make sure you're accepted and approved by the society, so you obviously enjoy the benefits of society, which is tremendous need fulfillment. Again, self-preservation, right? Third psychological need. Then there's an interesting fourth psychological need. You know what that's called? That's called self-worth. You want to call it self-worth, you want to call it self-esteem, you want to call it self-approval, self-respect. I don't care what you call it. It's all the same thing. The need for self-worth. Now, what is self-worth? What does it mean? It's different than adequacy. What's the opposite of self-worth? If you don't feel that you have self-worth, what do you feel? Worthless. Or you feel inferior. Okay? We now see that inadequacy, insecurity, inferiority are all three different things. Each one the opposite of the need that they reflect. When you do not feel worthful, when you don't have self-worth, you have what's called feelings of inferiority. Okay? Not feelings of inadequacy. Of course, they're very much tied, of course. If you feel inferior, you're going to feel inadequate, you know? I mean, you can look at the... Of course, they're very much together, but really they're different because you can distinguish them. For instance, you can have a person who has $1 million, right? So he feels very secure, right? And he feels adequate because he's got money, but he can feel very inferior because he inherited from his father. He never made it, so he doesn't feel that he made the money. He feels very inferior. There are many rich people who inherited their wealth who have tremendous feelings of inferiority because they know they never made it. They know they're sponging off their father or whatever. So you can see, you can be inferior yet feel secure and adequate. And so on. There are other variations. Each one is a different need. Now, feelings of worth. What is worth? Let me give you an example where you can feel inadequate but still have self-worth. You know where? Let's say you're a seasonal worker and you're very skilled, right? Now all of a sudden they laid you off, right? Because they don't have any work, or it's seasonal. You don't feel inferior, self-worth, because you know you're a skilled worker. But you feel inadequate in a certain sense, or insecure certainly, because you don't have any job now. Just because you have no job doesn't mean you feel inferior. You have very strong confidence and feelings of self-worth, except you feel inadequate, or rather you feel insecure because you lost your job, you see? So there are certain variations in one each one feeling, but basically they're different, and so these are the ideas. Now, self-worth. What does self-worth mean? Self-worth means to feel that you are somebody, to feel you are something, right? The opposite of that is to feel like you're nobody and nothing. But what does somebody mean? It means what the words say, some. Body, that there's a body there. What does nobody mean? No body. There's nothing there. The same idea with it. You will feel like you're something, there's something here, and nothing. No thing. When a person has self-worth, he feels like he's somebody. There's a certain sense of self. When a person feels worthless, inferior, right? There's a loss of sense of self. You feel like you're nothing, like you're nobody. Right? So we see that the need for self-worth is really a need for what? A need for a sense of being. Right? A need for a sense of being. It's different than the others. You've got to feel like you're something or somebody. That's what self-worth is. When you feel inferior or worthless, you feel like you're nothing. You're nobody. In fact, that's the words used to describe worthlessness. Is nobody. You're a nobody. You're nothing. That's what that you self feel. That's what the opposite of self-worth is. So we see that the psychological need and drive of self-worth is the sense of self that a person must have about themselves. Now, let's take a look at this drive called self-worth. If you begin to think about it, it doesn't make sense. Why doesn't it make sense? Why does a person have to feel like he's somebody? I can understand why a person has to feel he's adequate, why he has to have a sense of security, acceptance, and so on. But what's the difference if I feel like somebody or not? What do I have a need to feel like somebody? Why do I automatically feel like nobody? Because the need means you really feel like nobody, and you want to feel like somebody. That's why it's a drive to try to get self-worth. So the question is, what sense does it make? Why should you feel this way? Why does the Rebbeinu Shem give a person such a need? You can function in life without this absurd idea of feeling like somebody, nobody. I can understand the other, they're tied to self-preservation. But why is the feeling of worth tied to self-preservation? Why do I have to feel like somebody and nobody? First question. Second idea is, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense. Existence is its own worth. The fact that you are is the raya brura that you're somebody. I mean, does this shtenda have to prove it's something? No, it's a shtenda. Does an animal have to prove it's something? Of course not, it's an animal. It is because it is. It's a somebody because it is. It exists. It doesn't make sense for a true being to feel like it's not a true being and have to go around trying to feel like it's something. I mean, it sounds absurd. Animals don't have, you know, in other words, what I'm trying to bring out is we're trying to understand what do you need it for, purposefully, what's it going to do to you. The rationale doesn't make sense. Existence is its own worth. The fact that you exist automatically means you're somebody. Why does a person feel like they're nobody and have to keep striving like they're somebody? Because people are always after doing things to achieve self-worth. The motive or the drive of self-worth is the most fundamental drive of all. Everybody's trying to feel like they're somebody. That's what determines everybody's actions in the end. Whether he feels like he's somebody or nobody. Everything else is really around that. So the question is, that's preposterous. You are somebody. You exist. Existence is its own worth, okay? A lizard doesn't running around feeling, trying to prove itself that it's somebody. It merely does what it does. It does according to its own nature. It acts like a lizard. It doesn't have to go around running after an illusion of proving it's somebody when it is somebody already. It exists. That's the second kasha. Anyway, for the first kasha is, what do we need self-worth for? And the second thing is that doesn't make sense. A real being doesn't strive to prove that it's real. It is real, because it exists. Okay, third kasha is the third kasha in self-worth. The whole thing is preposterous. Why? Think of it. What does self-worth mean? It means worth to whom? When we say something is worth something, what does it mean? Worth to who? Worth means there's a value on it, right? Right? That's what worth means. So when we say I have self-worth, means I am valued by something or somebody, whatever. Now, what it really begins as is that I'm valued by people. Because how do we achieve feelings of self-worth? We achieve feelings of self-worth in three ways. One is we achieve feelings of worth based on the values and standards of others, if we conform to them. As a child, we grew up among parents, right? If you didn't listen to your parents, you felt worthless because somehow your sense of self or being was because you listened to the values and standards of parents. And then after parents, society took over. So what you merely did was you internalized parents' standards and values, which is called conscience, and now you have to live up to your own conscience. That's all, it's a switch. But the major idea is that you are living in accordance with standards and values of others, and that gives you a sense of worth. Man internalizes that and becomes a conscience, okay? But you're still doing the same thing, except now you don't need external people, you've already built it internally. That's one way. A second way we achieve feelings of worth is by acceptance and approval by others. which obviously means if we are going according to the standards and values of others, we then of course will be accepted and approved by others. But acceptance and approval by other people, it gives us feelings of self-worth. If you are rejected by people, if you are ostracized, you are going to feel inferior. If you are accepted by people, you're going to feel great. That's what it is. Our feelings of worth are tremendously wrapped up in how others view us. If they accept us, if they approve of us, their standards and their values. Okay? So that's basically two ways of how we feel good about ourselves. There's a third way, and that is how productive are you? If you don't do anything, you are going to feel worthless. I don't care who approves of you. People achieve a sense of worth, which is a sense of being, right? By going out and doing, being productive, being successful. When a guy makes $1 million, he feels like he's murdering. Why? He got a tremendous feeling of self-worth because he made $1 million by himself. Or so he thinks, right? So therefore, your level of productivity, of achievement, of striving, gives you tremendous feelings of self-worth. So that's how you get your feelings of self-worth. But wait, if that's the case, then it doesn't make sense. Then if my worth is dependent on others, people's values and standards, do you know that depending on where you live, every society has different values and standards? For instance, let's say you're a very intelligent person. So if you're born to parents who are college professors, you will feel great, because that's exactly what their values and standards are. What happens, but let's say you're weak athletically. Let's say you're born to people in Borneo, and they don't care how intelligent you are. They don't care how fast of a runner and how good of a hunter you are, right? So all of a sudden, your talents, your assets of intelligence doesn't mean a schmeck tabak in Borneo. So you may feel worthless because you're not good athletically. So it comes out, had you been born in the right circumstances, you would feel terrific about yourself. But if you're born in Borneo, you feel terrible about yourself. Again, another mashal. In America, if you do not steal, that's considered the standard and worthwhile. But if you are born in a mafia family, they'll kick you out. I mean, that's part of their standards and values. If you are born in Arabia where there's a lot of thievery going on, Geneva, like Hazal say, that they have Geneva, you are going to feel terrible because you're not a thief. So in other words, it comes out that your worth is relative. That even if you have a sense of self-worth, does that really mean that you're worth something? Or it merely means that in the society you grew up in, you developed self-worth because you conform to their values. In other words, what we see is that even if you feel self-worth, it doesn't mean anything. Because had you been born in another society with the very same personality, you'd feel worthless. So therefore, even if you have feelings of self-worth, they shouldn't be a true sense of being. Because it's a relative, what gives you worth is relative to the society that you were brought up in. And like I gave you an example, if you have a certain skill which is valueless in your society, you will develop emotional problems. If you had that skill in another society, another parents or whatever, you would not have emotional problems. Okay? So therefore we see that worth itself is purely relative. In other words, no matter what you are, in some society you would have made it. So why should a person feel inferior? Why should he feel worthless? Because he's not as intelligent as everybody or whatever. Because every person has certain talents that had they been born in that mishpacha, they would have felt great about themselves. So if a person feels inferior, the whole thing is an illusion. He shouldn't. And if a person feels worth, he should, because somebody else, he would have been worthless. So there is no even criteria for worth. Right? So again, so the third kash is, the whole thing doesn't make sense, because the way you get worth is preposterous. Your feelings of inferiority are really worthless, in an illusion, and your feelings of worthiness are an illusion, because you could have been rejected or accepted depending on where you live. So therefore, the only worth of a person is not worth to anybody, but the fact that you exist is your own worth. You either make it on your own or you die on your own. What's the difference? There's no indication of worth here. The question, can you make it or not? So the question is, what in the world is self-worth all about? This is the question that we're bothered with so far. We do not understand the psychological reason for self-worth, Other psychological needs and drives have sense. Self-worth does not make any sense. Okay. And self-worth is the greatest, most fundamental drive of all. And you, in every pathological syndrome you'll look, you'll always find incredible feelings of inferiority, rejection, isolation, not loved, not being cared for. It always winds up the same thing, feeling like a nobody. So if it's that important, you think it made sense. You think if everybody was sick about that feeling, you think it made sense to feel that way. But it doesn't. So the question is, then why does man have that need? If it doesn't really make any sense, and it really is not even, there's no criteria even to really give you self-worth. What's going on? One kasha. Okay? Next question. And let's take a look at certain fundamental psychological areas. Let me introduce it really as a fourth question. If we see that the standards and values of society changes, therefore they are not the criteria that should give a person either inferiority or feelings of worth. So the question then, what can give a person true feelings of worth if it's not those kind of ideas? Okay? So this is an analysis of a psychological need called self-worth or self-esteem, and we begin to see that it's difficult to really to understand. Okay. So far we have certain questions. The first question was, what is the fundamental drive of mankind? The second question is, what is the fundamental conflict of mankind? The third question is an analysis of self-worth. And we see that it's really difficult to understand the whole ideas of self-worth. Now, let's take a fourth question. Let's go into another psychological phenomenon. Now, it's very interesting that you'll find that when an infant is born, okay, there's a certain concept in psychology called primary process thinking. What does that mean? It simply means that when an infant is born, okay, and it obviously has all kinds of needs that it's becoming very much aware of, right? Food and so on, right? All of a sudden, what it does is it pictures something in its mind, and somehow that is able to satiate, to a certain extent, the drive of the child. In other words, it's a very interesting kind of act. In other words, to think about something almost is able to fulfill the need, even though you're not eating anything. This is an idea called primary process thinking. It's the beginning process of thinking. Of course, as an infant realizes that it is just not going to do it this way, right? Then it begins thinking in the pattern called secondary process thinking or reality testing, where it actually realizes, wait a minute, I'm not going to get my needs met, my thinking about them or whatever, the answers to them. I got to go out there and get it fulfilled. I have to go into reality and do what's called problem solving. I got to solve the problem of how to get my needs and so on. This is the gradual thinking or sophistication of the infant's thinking process as it gets older and older. And the whole idea of competency is to be able to become skillful in problem solving of reality and how to live in this world. So therefore, there is a notion called primary process thinking where there's an escape or a run to thinking about the solution. And that itself is almost a solution. Now, you think that as infants you gave it up? It's not true. Because it remains with you in adulthood. You know how? Dreams. What are dreams? When you dream, dreaming is to a great extent wish fulfillment. Okay? There are other ideas in dreaming, but one of the ideas, it fulfills a wish or a need. Something you cannot consciously do while you're awake, you do unconsciously while you're asleep. And dreams have a wish fulfillment aspect. For instance, there was once a case where people I think soldiers stationed up in Siberia or, you know, in the North Pole or whatever, they were very hungry, they ran out of food, and all of a sudden after 2 or 3 days, all they did was dream about food. So obviously the mind, why is the mind dreaming about food? Not because it's yearning for food, because the mind dreaming about food somehow satiates hunger in some way. Dreaming is what's called primary process thinking used by an adult. You know what's another way? Daydreaming. That you do even when you're awake. Somehow when you dream or you have daydreams about being a hero or, you know, whatever daydreams people have and so on, there's a certain sense of satisfaction. So the question is, like, why in the world is the mind using that method at all. So even though you stop using it as an infant, you continue using it as an adult in more sophisticated forms, that's all. And a person who has access or uses daydreaming too often, obviously that's you're talking about emotional health disorder. So that's the question. How do we understand primary process thinking? That idea, which all infants have, it's universal. Okay. Another question. Why is it that whenever you look at children, there's always this incredible delusion of grandiosity that kids have? Kids have incredible omnipotent fantasies, illusions, that they're a god and so on. But not that they think, and that's why kids think that magic, kids believe in magic because they think it's the divine-like quality, you know? If I think, I can do. Because thinking and being able to do is really omnipotent. That's why there's a confusion of reality. But the idea is, why is there an infantile sense or feeling of omnipotence? And the truth is, that feeling of omnipotence never goes away. All people think that they are God in a certain way. There are still feelings of omnipotence in the sense of you think you can do things which are not in conformity with reality. Those delusions or grandiosities, those feelings of omnipotence, which began from day one as an infant, never goes away, really. So the question is, where does that come from? What does that mean? Where does it come from? What does it mean to have these kind of delusions of omnipotence? Now, you need much more than just a neshama to answer. Neshama, the catch-all term, you know? You know, how, what, where, when, and why? And it's like, anyway. So the idea, of course, is where does it come from? And you should know the drive for omnipotence is one of the most fundamental drives that human beings have. It determines almost everything they do. Power struggles, money, you name it. It's all part of omnipotence and ego trip, whatever you want to call it. So the question is, where does it come from in an infant? I mean, what's going on here, really? You know? Next, we have to begin to analyze the ideas of gaiva and anivus. What is gaiva? Gaiva is called arrogance, haughtiness, right? And anivus is humility, humble, right? Is gaiva a midah, a good character trait? Is anivus a good character trait? Or is there something pivotal about gaiva? It was this gaiva a midah, like you're not supposed to get angry, you're supposed to be bach chesed, you're supposed to be, you know, there are many midas, good character traits a person is supposed to have. One of them is called gaiva, not to be about gaiva. Not to be haughty, arrogant, condescending, or whatever. What should you be? Humble, right? Humility, have humility, and so on. So the question is, are these good traits that you should have? Or are they fundamental and pivotal? It's not just a trait. It's the trait that everything stands on. Question. Next. Let me give you... The Messias Hishon, Ramosh Chaim Matzati, also wrote a sefer, a Musa sefer. He called it Messias Hishon. The path of the righteous, whatever. And that sefer is interesting because it analyzes what a man should do, right? Not in terms of midas, good traits. There are other musas from that go through the different traits, not to be angry, not to be selfish, and so on. But Messias Hisham is a sefer that analyzes not through different traits, but through levels of achievement. For instance, the first level is Zoraz, to be very zealous in doing mitzvahs. And that level of zealousness cuts across every mitzvah, right? It's a level of achievement that cuts across all midas, right? Then there are further levels, the levels of kitar and kedusha, sanctity. Everything, all those levels that he gives is a statement on the levels. And all the midas cut across each level. The last thing that he mentions is called onuf, anivus. But wait a minute. Onuf means humility, humble. But is humility a midah, a trait, or is it a level? From the Sefer Hishon, one gets the distinct idea that humility is not a trait. It's a level of attainment, which means that all traits fall on the level called humility. But how? And not only that, but it's the last level. Why? What does it mean? Okay, that's again another question that has to be analyzed. Another idea. Let me ask you, I'm going to give you a case of two different people. You tell me who the Bar Gaiva is, okay? You tell me the Bar Gaiva, which one? Case A, person goes into an office and he screams at people, get away from me, who are you? He treats everybody contemptuously. He condescends to everybody. He walks around on $500 suits, you know, and he talks to people as if he owns the world, you know? That's case A. Case B, a nice guy, a good worker, but he enjoys life tremendously. He really enjoys life. He takes his vacations. He's a nice guy. He could talk in like a mansion, so on. He's a regular guy. But he enjoys life. He's into life. He goes on vacations. He's into hobbies and so on and so forth. But he's a great guy. He's a nice guy to talk to. There's no condescension. He doesn't speak to you contemptuously and so on. That's case B. Who is the Bhagaiva? We say that you shouldn't be arrogant, but wait a minute, isn't there such a thing called self-respect? A person has to have self-respect. What's the difference between a person who has self-respect and gaiva? I mean, we know you have to have self-respect. If you don't have self-respect, you're going to have emotional problems. Mm-hmm. So obviously you have to have self-respect. But if you have self-respect, if you believe in yourself, you're a bhagaiva. But we know there's something wrong here. You mean to stay out of mental health, mental disease, you have to be a bhagaiva? So then what does it mean? Okay. I'm going to have to stop here because it's late. I'm sorry, but I have to stop here. I'll continue next. No, not because I want to torture you. I have to stop here because the shiur is over and I'll have to continue next week. Okay, last week we had gone to some of the ideas of how do Hashkofa principles manifest themselves in certain psychological phenomena. And it's very important to understand, because one begins to see that the human body or the entire Odom is really made up of that which he needs physically and psychologically in order to get Olam Haba. In order to get Olam Haba, you need certain requirements. If you recall what I spoke about, the requirements of Olam Hazeh. And the person, both physically and psychologically, has those needs and drives in order to make sure that the requirements for Olam Hazeh is fulfilled. So I started that last week. Now, just to go over, I want to go over the questions that I had asked last week, and then I'll proceed from there. First question I asked was, what is the fundamental psychological need, which means a deficiency, and therefore the drive that an Odom, that a person has? And how do we understand that in terms of Hashkofa, the Torah framework, as being necessary in order to fulfill his tachas? The second question is, what is the fundamental psychological conflict that a person has, again, in order to fulfill his tachas? We also, the third question, we went into the idea of why do you need the drive called, or the psychological need called, self-worth. I had analyzed other psychological needs, and they made sense in terms of self-preservation. But the need to feel like somebody, self-worth, doesn't really make sense. What do you need it for? What's the point? The fourth kasha is that besides the fact that we don't understand why we need it, it doesn't make sense. Why do we have to prove that we're somebody? We are somebody. We exist. Existence is its own self-worth. So if that's the case, why do we have to prove it all the time? Why do we have to go after things which give us self-esteem or self-worth? The fifth kasha is, if that's the case, if self-worth is really a relative concept, if you recall, that's really relative to where you live. So therefore, if you feel good about yourself, maybe if you've been born in another country, you feel terrible about yourself because those people would not value what you have. And if you feel terrible about yourself, maybe it's also not true, because in this place you don't have the good values that people want, but in other places maybe you do. So the whole idea of its relative worth, so therefore your estimate of yourself in terms of being somebody is really false. It's based on illusions. What is the true worth that is not relative in any way? That's the fifth kasha. Then I had gone into certain psychological phenomena. The idea of primary process thinking, what is it? Why is it in an infant? Primary process thinking, for those who don't remember, is where the person, the infant, all he has to do is think of the thing and somehow he fulfills part of the need. So the question is, Why does an infant do that? Where does it get this whole idea of thinking, and therefore it happens? This idea of primary process thinking. In addition, we all know that all infants have tremendous omnipotent feelings. It's infantile omnipotent feelings. Where do they get this from? Well, what's the why is this true? The next kasha, the eighth kasha, is the idea of gaivan anivus. Are they merely midas, or are they more pivotal, central to really what Yiddishkeit, Yahadus, is really all about? The ninth kasha is the idea of the Messias Hashem. Messias Hashem is a Musa Sefer which deals with levels that interact with all midas at each level. But yet we find in the Sefer the midah called anivus, onuf. But an onuf is not a level. A humility is a midah, it's a character trait. It's not a level of achievement in any way. So therefore, why is it in the Messias Hashem? And not only that, why is it last? This is the ninth kasha. The tenth kasha is, I gave an example of two individuals. Which is the Bar Gaiva? One individual is the person who is very arrogant, overbearing, haughty, very condescending. And the second was the example of a person who is a very nice person, likable person, easy to get along with, and he goes on vacations, he does what he wants, he lives life to the fullest. Which one is the real Bar Gaiva? This is the question that I had asked. Tenth kasha. So the 11th kasha was, what's the difference between self-respect and gaiva? I mean, a person has to hold from himself. Is that gaiva? I mean, does a person have to be emotionally disturbed to hold inferiority and then he won't be a Bar Gaiva? Does tzidkus take emotional disturbance in an individual? Of course not. So obviously self-respect is not the same as gaiva. So the question, of course, is what is the difference? Those are 11 kashas that I left you with last week. And I'll ask you one more kasha, which is the 12th kasha. The 12th kasha is, I'll give you three different cases of an onuf. Who is the real onuf? The first case is an individual who's a very big Bar Chesed. Person does whatever you want. Very likable person, speaks very kindly, very softly and gently, will do anybody a favor. Yet this person obviously has emotional problems in certain areas. It's hard for him to keep his job. It's hard for him to do things. It's hard for him perhaps to make a marriage work or whatever. Is this person an onuf? That's one question. That's the first example. Another example. A person who's a tzaddik, person is a tzaddik, he's a very righteous person, he knows how to learn, and he's humble, and he functions in all areas very nicely. And he's also very humble in the sense that he speaks very gently, doesn't hold himself a lot, doesn't condescend. Is this person an onuf? Third person is a person of this description. This person, when you speak to him, he speaks like a very gentle man. You see that he has humility, right? He does favors for people. But when you speak to him in certain areas, for instance, if you speak to him in learning, you see that he's very opinionated. He won't yield on anything. You see that he holds very much with what he feels to be the truth. That there's a certain sense of self that he holds very much from. But he displays very humble traits. Is this person an onuf? Okay, I've given you three different kinds of people. And all three of these kinds of people exist in all different people that have humility. The question is, who's the real onuf? Okay? And also, in each person, are they an onuf? And if they are not an onuf, why not? Okay, these are the 12 questions which I would like to leave you with. And in this year, I would like to somehow try to answer and give you a framework of what goes on mitzat Torah. Now, if you recall, the shiur previous to this, we had spoken about what is the interaction between the guf and the neshama. You remember? The fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam takes the neshama and puts it or inserts it into a guf against its will. What are the phenomena that the neshama feels? What happens as a result of that experience? And you recall I had gone through several different ideas, very important ideas. The first idea, to recapitulate for those who are, you know, don't recall, is one of the most significant changes that the neshama experiences, of course, is that the guf is now an obstacle to the dvekas that it was having before it came into the guf. The neshama receives a tremendous amount of yichud with the Ribbono Shel Olam, dvekas, clinging to God. It experiences the Ribbono Shel Olam in terms of itself, It feels God as part of itself, and in that sense it feels shalom, perfect, because God is perfect, and experiences God as part of itself. It experiences God as a source, and it's also mishtalim, feels perfect. It loses that. All of a sudden it's severed from the Ribbono Shel Olam. As a result of the fact that it goes into the guf. I spent the whole shiur previously explaining the whole phenomena, guf and zikuch haguf and so on. But that is one of the most significant events that happens, results, as a result of the fact that neshama goes into the guf. It loses contact with the Ribbono Shel Olam. The second thing is loses contact with its own nature. It doesn't experience itself as a neshama anymore. It doesn't know that it's a neshama. It loses contact with its own nature, whatever the nature of the neshama is. The third idea is that all it's left with is a sense of self. That's all it's left with. It's not in contact with the Ribbono Shel Olam or in terms of its own nature. All it sees, the neshama, all it now recognizes is that it is a being that is aware of itself as a being. That's all. That's all it's aware. It looks out on the world, the way everybody's looking out here, and it sees the world. Doesn't know who it is. You think you're a body, but you're not Margish the neshama that you really are. You are not your body. You are really the neshama. So therefore, it's not masig itself. It's only masig itself as a being. And it thinks of itself as being human, since it's inserted in the body. In addition, it perceives all of a sudden, by the fact that it's now in the human body, all of a sudden it begins feeling all kinds of needs and drives, all kinds of taivas and everything like that. The body is what has the needs and drives, not the neshama. But the neshama, which does not distinguish now between itself and the body, thinks that it has the needs and drives. The chumer, the physical body, is that which has needs and drives, not the neshama. But it thinks that it has. So therefore you begin, by the fact that you're in the guf, the neshama thinks now that it has needs and drives, which it now begins perceiving. And they're forceful. They force the neshama to do things, go out and fulfill those needs and drives that the neshama has. And the fifth idea is that the neshama, which has all the faculties that a human being has, it can see and hear and so on, can only now do those faculties via the body, through the body. It can only see through the eyes, not through its own eyes. The neshama has its own way of seeing, which is not through eyes. It can only see through the guf. So therefore, if a person goes blind, then the neshama goes blind. Not because it cannot see, because it's nigzah, that it cannot use its own faculties, its own assets, characteristics, organs, whatever they are, in order to acquire sight. It can only use the guf's eyes for sight. So therefore, the neshama's faculties can only be done through the body. These are the ideas that I had spoken about, that is the influence of the neshama when it's inserted in the guf. There's something else that happens, and that is that when the neshama is nifrad from the Ribbono Shel Olam, what happens if you are connected to a source that is perfect, that is the true being, right? And from there you get your own sense of perfection, your own sense of self and being, and all of a sudden you're nifrad, you're split, no more dvekus. What do you begin feeling? Choser, deficient. If the only way you can feel sholem is by being connected with the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? Because he is the only being and he's the only sholem being. We are not being really in our own self, and we're not sholem. If you're disconnected from the Ribbono Shel Olam, what happens? You begin feeling a loss of sense, a loss of a sense of self, of I, of being. That's what happens when a sholem is put into a guf. It has a tremendous loss of that sense that it is, that is a being, an I, an identity. This is what happens also as a result of the fact that the neshama is put into the guf. As a result of that, the neshama now has what's called an existential need. What is that? A need means a deficiency. The neshama, by its being placed in a guf, or when we look at the total of that, which is called Adam, right? Man, right? Automatically, by its very state, it now has a need, a deficiency, that it does not feel a sense of self. It feels a loss of self, that there's nothing there. It's an existential state. By the mere fact that Hashem exists in the goof, it feels this. It doesn't learn this from anything, it doesn't get it from the environment or whatever. It's what's called an existential state of inferiority, merely by the fact that it's no more dovak in the Ribbono Shel Olam. This now will have tremendous repercussions on what happens in the psychological area. So therefore, again, the neshama, by being the goof, now gets an existential inferiority because it's severed from the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? Therefore, existentially, by existence itself, in the fact that it's an odom, now has a tremendous need, a deficiency of being. Therefore, it has a drive to do what? Whenever there's a need, there's always a drive. The drive is to what? Is to get that sense of self back again. In other words, it has a drive to what? To assert, to confirm being, to reaffirm, to verify, to corroborate itself again as a real being. That becomes an existential drive. What repercussions does this have so far on the individual? Let's take a look now at the infant. And we begin seeing how this comes out psychologically. That which happens to the neshama because it goes into the goof now begins having tremendous repercussions in the mental state of a person. Take an infant. An infant is born. Immediately, the neshama, which is in the goof, has that need, that deficiency. So it has a drive again to reassert itself, to confirm that it really is a being, automatically. So what happens is it immediately wants to feel, deny that feeling. What's the opposite of feeling you're nobody? Feeling you're somebody. So it immediately begins thinking of itself as omnipotent. Mm-hmm. It's the reverse of feeling like nothing. It's the reverse of feeling like everything. So therefore the feelings of infantile omnipotence that all infants have, this almost godlike thought that it is God, is the opposite, is the fulfillment of that incredible lack of need. But how does the infant get these feelings of omnipotence? Merely by thinking. It thinks it is God, therefore it is God. What do you mean? Things don't get happen by thinking. Do you remember what primary process thinking is? Where my thinking, it happens. That's a divine act. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam desires or wills and it happens. But the neshama is confused. Why? Because when the neshama is an infant, it has a very immature ego. It means that there's no real mind that can perceive the world, right? It still doesn't know much about the universe. It's still an infant. So therefore, it still leans back on its abilities as a neshama. How does a neshama get things done? It wills. It doesn't do it like the human body, where you have to go act in the real world. The neshama merely thinks, and it is, because the neshama is a chelik l'kai mimal, so it has the same kind of powers in that way as the Ribbono Shel Olam. It wills, then it happens. So since the neshama is in a body with an immature ego, right, an immature self that recognizes reality for what it is, it now leans back on what it used to do. So it thinks and merely it happens. That's why the neshama or the infant tries out primary process thinking. Primary process thinking is nothing more than what the neshama used to do. It's the ability of a soul to think and merely it happens. And why does the infant do that? Because it doesn't recognize that in this universe you must act and do in order to get things done. It's not a sophisticated ego yet. So therefore it still thinks that it has the powers of the neshama. So it tries to do the primary process thinking by merely willing or desiring, and bam. So what does the neshama do? It uses a method where it could use as a neshama, because it's not aware that that method doesn't work in this world, because its ego is not sophisticated to interpret the world. And what does it think that it has? Omnipotence. So merely by desiring omnipotence, bam, it feels omnipotent. That's the understanding of what primary process thinking. It's the old mechanism, it's the vestiges of the neshama that it could do, except the infant does it because it doesn't have the mature ego, and what it does is it gets a sense of self-omnipotence. This is the way the infant works. Now, that, after a while, so we can look at it sort of as that the need and drive is to assert the self, right? The method is the primary process thinking, which the neshama could do in the first place. That's a divine act, right? And what is, that's the method. What does it get with the method? It gets the feelings of omnipotence, but it can only do this because its ego is still immature. It doesn't perceive that the world it's in now is no more a world you can think and it becomes. You must work and actively engage in the world. That's why it does pull that stunt when it's young. As the infant begins growing up, the ego gets more sophisticated, right? So he realizes that it cannot primarily process its way to feelings of grandiosity, to feelings of omnipotence, which it needs because it has a tremendous loss of sense of self, because it was nifrat in the Ribbono Shel Olam. You see? So as the ego gets more sophisticated, it drops that primary process thinking. But we still see vestiges of that primary process thinking in an adult, in dreams, daydreams. You still see the smatterings of what the neshama could do and what it tried as an infant, even in the adult. And you'll notice that children, in terms of, children have what's called magical thinking. Many kids, you know, when they, especially when they play, like they think and they believe that something can happen merely from their thought. That's why kids feel very guilty if they have a death wish against their parents, psychologically. Many times they think that they really can kill their parents, so they're frightened of their own thoughts. Very important psychological phenomenon of kids. Because they have magical thinking, they feel like they can actually harm their parents by their thought. But wait a minute, they can't do that. The teretz is, the reason why they think that way is because they're still children and they're still relying on some of the methods of the neshama. But when the ego gets more sophisticated, then the fear of magical thinking drops because they realize they cannot do anything by thinking alone. As long as they have an unsophisticated ego, an immature ego, then they pull off primary process thinking, which is really magical thinking. To will, to desire, is to do. When the ego gets more sophisticated, then children don't use magical thinking anymore. As the neshama learns that it's no more in the in its divine state, but now in man's state, an odom, it cannot do that anymore. So therefore it can only interact. It doesn't feel bad that it wishes death because it knows it cannot happen, because it knows in reality these things don't happen anymore. But that explains why kids have magical thinking. It's the old vestiges of the way neshama used to do things. Now, in other words, I just want to mention that one of the fundamental ideas is that the neshama loses the sense of former identity, which it is a neshama, and has a new identity called odom, man. And this is what it has to relearn, that it is an odom. This is what it thinks, and it has to, because it's put in the body, it has to learn what the new identity of odom is, therefore the ego has to mature. As I mentioned, so therefore the dreams and daydreams are the vestiges of the powers of the neshama which remain in the individual. Now, let's go further. Person begins to grow up. His ego becomes more sophisticated. What does that really mean? That means he's able to perceive reality much better. And he realizes that thinking is not going to do anything. He's got to go out and do. But he still has that need and drive, right? To assert self, to confirm or verify that he's a being. Now we see that drive as self-worth. Self-worth is nothing more. The psychological drive of self-worth is nothing more than that existential drive that the neshama has automatically as a result of the fact that it was placed into the guf, and therefore it's separated from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it comes out as self-worth. So the drive of self-worth is to do what? To confirm that you're a self, a being, that you're something, you're not a nobody, you're somebody, right? It's the drive to again regain its sense of self or I. That's what self-worth is. And self-worth, which psychologists think is psychological, is not. It's a spiritual drive. It's a drive which is an existential drive that results from the fact that the neshama is in the guf and is severed from the true being, the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the neshama, or the psychological drive of self-worth, which we now recognize, is really a spiritual existential drive, right? That's why everybody has it automatically, except it looks different in the infant. In the adult, it's self-worth. How does an adult now begin fulfilling this self-worth? Well, since the adult now has a sophisticated view of reality, right? It's able to do or fulfill the self-worth in basically one of four ways. Not like the infant that can primary process think or will and it happens. Since it has a sophisticated ego, it knows that it cannot do it that way. It must involve itself in reality Okay? So therefore, what are the methods by which it will gain a sense of self? Well, there are basically four. The first method which immediately the person begins doing is to do what? It realizes that if it can express its will, then it must be somebody. Meaning, if you want something and you can express it, and you can go after it and do it, you want to do what you want, that immediately says you're somebody. Because only a real being desires and can get the fulfillment of those desires. So the first way that the neshama, or rather let's look at it in terms of Adam satiates this drive of self-worth is by expressing its will. I want to do what I want to do. You ever see the action? Was ich will, you know? It's what I want. It's irrelevant what I want. That's not the issue of what I want, what you want. It's I want to do what I want, not what you want. It's the I want that gives a sense. Why? What do you mean I want? Because I'm somebody too. You'll learn who I am. You ever hear those kind of statements? You'll see who you're dealing with. That's always expressions of I'm somebody too. It's the expression of will and the conclusion in the sense of fulfilling will that gives a person a tremendous sense of self. Now, what do we include in the real world? Tivus. What does a person want in this world? He wants what? Pleasure. In other words, a person was given pleasures, taiva, to give a person what he wants. A person says, I want to do what I want to do. But if I have no pleasure in anything, I don't want anything. In order to make an issue about it, you got to give me something that I want to do, and I say, this is what I want to do. So what the Rebbe Hashem did is he put in the chumah itself has taiva, pleasures. So therefore, a person can say, I want to do what I want to do, because I want to reassert myself, but what do I want to do? I want to do pleasure, taiva. So taiva gives you the direction that you can express your will in. But what you're primarily doing is exercising or doing what you want to do. In other words, what you're doing is you're expressing your will through taiva. Taiva gives you the direction that you can make a stand on. You got to stand on something. We stand on taiva. So the chorma has taiva that you express your will through. Because that's what you want. But the truth is that you are doing it, not only because of the pleasure involved, but it's really an expression of will. And that is what gives you a tremendous sense of self. Okay? First way. Second way. Another way of doing it is by you exercising your being, merely by existing and doing productivity. Doing itself is a proof that you're somebody. When we are successful in doing something, if you build something, for instance, a beautiful house, you know, you have a certain sense, I'm somebody. That's why many times people who do manual labor have a tremendous sense of self. They fix things, they build things, productivity, getting things done gives you a tremendous sense of self, because only a self obviously can get things done. So therefore, what you try to do is what's called exercise being by being. You try to be, you try to do. So productivity is another way of getting a tremendous sense of self. The third way is by gaining control, power, and mastery over others. Because if you can control other beings, then you certainly are a real being. And what is the way that most people engage in controlling a sense of mastery and power? Two ways. The most fundamental way is called possessions. We acquire things. Why? Why does man always buying and so on? Besides the fact that they allow him to have taiva or whatever, but there's another element. Power, control. If I own 10,000 sheep, I control a certain aspect of reality, right? If I have a company, and I own a tremendous company, I control a whole company. You see? So possessions give somebody a sense of power, mastery, or control. And that gives the neshama, therefore, a sense of self, which it needs in the first place. The second way we get control and mastery is by rulership, by ruling over other people, which is really very similar to the first. Why is it countries are always going to war to acquire new land? Why is people always trying to become king and so on? Why are people always trying to become managers and so on? Because it's always great. You feel great when you're a manager, an executive manager of a whole company. The sense of rulership over other people gives you a sense of control and mastery that gives you, therefore, a sense of self. The reason why people want power and mastery and control is because they want a sense of self, not because they want power. But one of the best ways of achieving a sense of self, which the person doesn't have, is by having possessions and rulership. The fourth way is an interesting way, and that is that the person, he wants the ability to be able to do everything. Forget about possessions or actually doing things or tivus, having tivus. But what happens if, forget about me being exercising these things. What happens if I have the ability to do everything? Wouldn't I feel like somebody? What gives, explain, what gives everybody the ability to do almost anything? The answer is money. Why do people save so much money besides the security and so on? Money is the most, one of the most powerful aphrodisiac for man's incredible illusions of omnipotence. Because the truth is, if you have $500 million at your disposal, let's say you own $500 million, do you have any idea what your sense of self looks like? Do you know that you can do almost anything available to man? There's certain things you can't, but that's almost, you can almost do anything. A person who has that kind of money is almost divine in that you could do anything. You can go where you want, you can do what you want, you can buy what you want, you can control what you want. A guy kicks you out of the hotel, you buy the hotel and kick him out. There are many, I think Howard Hughes once did that. Or Getty once did that. Some waiter talked disrespectfully, or something. He bought the hotel and he fired the waiter. Well, that's the idea. With that kind of money, you can do anything you want. So merely the ability to do is an omnipotent kind of feeling that you get. And of course, what gives us the ability to do, of course, is wealth, money. Of course, money leads. With money, you then can have power and control, mastery. You can have exercise, productivity, because you can buy anything to build, right? You can have tivus. But there's something that money has besides these. You could sit in your house and do nothing and yet feel great because you have $100 million of your own. Because money is the ability to do. Besides the means, you have the wherewithal, the means, the ability, the capacity to do. Even if you don't do, the fact that you have that much wealth means you walk around with a chip on your shoulder that's 5 miles high. Just from that alone, the wealth itself gives you an incredible sense of self without exercising it. So therefore we see that there are four ways that a man strives in order to give himself the sense of self or being or identity or I that he lost because of the fact that he's placed into the goof. So we see that the drive of self-worth is an existential drive that happens as a result of the fact that he is an Odom and not just a Neshama. And therefore man strives in all these kind of directions. Now, what happens after a person has achieved all these, what does he begin feeling? He begins feeling a sense of self. But wait a minute, there are different levels of a sense of self. Different levels of a person feeling as somebody. What are those levels? Basically three. The first level is a person feels that he is somebody. It's what they call self-complacent. Yes, I'm somebody. You're also somebody, but I'm somebody too. You see, self-complacency. I feel that I'm really somebody, but I don't feel superior to other people. That's what's called the first level of sense of self, which we now will begin to call gaiva. Gaiva is nothing more than a sense of self. Wait. So therefore, the first level of gaiva, or the sense of self that a person does in reaction to the fact that he needs a sense of self, is self-complacency, where he feels that he is somebody, but he doesn't feel superior to others. He's not condescending or arrogant. The second level is what's called arrogance. Chutzpah or haughtiness. What is that? That means not only am I somebody, but I am better than you. I am really somebody. I am superior than everybody else. That's gaiva. That kind of gaiva you find in people who are condescending, who talk down to people, in other words. People really think that they're God's gift to this universe. Okay? And there are, of course, there are variations in that itself, but that's the second category. The third category of gaiva is people who not only think they're somebody, who think they're better than everybody, right? But people who think that they are the only thing that counts. They are God. There you're talking about megalomania, egomania, grandiosity, delusions of omnipotence, egoistic, egotistic, whatever you want to call it. The idea is that these people are infatuated with their own greatness beyond other men and beyond even the Rebbeinu Shlalom. They think the universe revolves around themselves. Okay? That's the third level of gaiva, which is obviously the greatest disturbance or form of gaiva that a person can really take.
They believe that intellectually.
Therefore, we have three different categories of gaiva that result from these methods, which was initiated in the first place because of the drive, the existential drive of self-worth. Therefore, we see that the person goes in this direction of these different ways of achieving the sense of self because the sophisticated ego realizes that he must interact with the environment in order to get the sense of self, not like the infant. So therefore, it drops primary process and it goes into what's called reality testing, meaning it has to actually engage itself in the real world. In these ways, it gets one of these three levels of self, which is gaiva, okay? And this is what the sophisticated ego does. As a result of that, we begin seeing that there are two drives for self. Every person is born with a drive to declare or assert himself as a real being. This is what's called existential gaiva, because it's based on existential inferiority. In fact, he's an Adam. The second kind is called psychological gaiva. What happens if a person is born in a home and he's very much rejected by his parents? He gets no love, no acceptance, they don't give him any confidence, he has no friends. This person will feel inferiority on a psychological level because the environment that he has grown up in is really giving him a loss of self. Because it's a terrible, stressful environment that's giving him the sense of inferiority. So this person not only has existential needs to declare himself as a real self, but he has psychological needs to declare himself as a real self in the real world. But that's the difference between existential gaiva and psychological gaiva. People who are arrogant and who function very normally and have no emotional problems are still can be very arrogant because they are responding to the existential gaiva. People who have a lot of emotional disturbance, sometimes a person will act like a bully because what he's really doing is denying his own feelings of inferiority, therefore he acts like a bully. That is coming from the fact that he psychologically feels like an inferiority as a result of his interaction with the environment. It's similar, but the gaiva comes from two different places. One comes from the mere existence of the person as an Adam, and the other comes with the interaction in the environment, and he can get feelings of inferiority. Of course, this person has now two gaivas to contend with, right? The sense of inferiority that comes as a result of his interaction with the environment, and the sense of gaiva, or the need for self, that comes from his automatic interaction, or rather being as an Adam. So there are two kinds of gaiva. But what are we really saying? When a person wants to assert himself, what is he really saying? Yeshayin Ravadoi, remember that statement? What is assertion of self? An assertion of self, which really what self-worth is trying to say is Yeshayin Ravadoi, I'm also somebody. But wait a minute. The whole tachlis of Yiddishkeit is to declare Einoidin Ravadoi, right? What are the Tayag mitzvahs all about? It's to declare that only the Rebbeinu Shlom is the emissar self or being. So it comes out that there's a paradox. A person is given a drive where he now runs around trying to declare Yeshayin Ravadoi, which means declaring or feeling a sense of self, right, and doing what he wants, expressing his will and all the other methods, when the whole tachas of Yiddishkeit is Einoid Mavadoi. Don't express your will, don't do taivas, don't do anything outside of the rotson of the Rebbeinu Shlom, because it's Einoid Mavadoi. But that's a paradox. So we now see that becomes a conflict. So we now see why a person has self-worth, the existential gaiva, because that creates the conflict between you or the Rebbeinu Shlom. And strangely speaking, that a person thinks that he achieves a sense of self by doing what he wants, the truth is that by doing what you want, you get further from the Rebbeinu Shlom, so you become less
of being. But by doing what the Rabbeinu Shlomo wants, you get closer to the Rabbeinu Shlomo, so you become more of a being. So it's a really contradiction, a paradox. If you become less of a being and not expressing your will and so on, then you get closer to the Rabbeinu Shlomo and therefore you become more of a being. If you, however, do the reverse and you do what the Rabbeinu Shlomo wants, so therefore you think that you're not expressing your will, you're doing less of what you want, you're not asserting self, you become more of a being, because only Rabbeinu Shlomo is a real being. So we come out that the whole idea, the existential drive, is there to make sure that you will be in the conflict of Yeshid Mavadoi or Enid Mavadoi. And Yeshid Mavadoi means Gaiva on one of those three levels. Enid Mavadoi is Anivus. That's what Anivus really is, and that's what humility, humbleness. That's what humility, Anivus really is Enid Mavadoi. The recognition that the Rabbeinu Shlomo is the only thing that exists leaves you with the feeling of loss of self in terms of self. But you meschaber, you connect with the Rabbeinu Shlomo. That's the real sense of self that you get by doing the will of the Rabbeinu Shlomo. That's an emerson onof. A gaiva is one who's into yeshid milvadoi, or maybe only he's the only yeshid, he's a megalomania. That's gaiva, that's the opposite. And the contradiction is that you actually become a self by doing what the Rabbeinu Shlomo wants, and that the reason why man has a drive to be somebody is to create the conflict, tension, that you now have to war between yourself and the Rabbeinu Shlomo. You want to declare yourself as somebody or the Rabbeinu Shlomo. That's why this, the fundamental conflict, psychological conflict, is self-worth versus the Rabbeinu Shlomo's worth, if you want to look at it that way. And the fundamental need or drive of a person is the existential drive of yesh that a person wants to feel. So we now see that those psychological ideas of self-worth is really that which creates the conflict, and it begins because of an existential state, and it throws you into the conflict of yeshid mevado and enid mevado, which you must therefore engage in. So either you come out being an onuf, which is enid mevado, and therefore really achieve a sense of being, or yeshid mevado, therefore you really lose your sense of being. One or the other. So with these, a psychological idea of self-worth is exactly what you need to go into the conflict of Enoid Mavadoi, Yeshid Mavadoi. And the reason why that is the conflict is because of, since in Olam Habo you're Masig Yehudoi, therefore the task is the same as the reward. You see how it's all one idea. Now, where do we see that in the Chumash? It's interesting when you look at the Parsha of Adam, Harishon. The Nachash was trying to seduce Adam, right? Talk Adam into doing what? Into doing the chet. What did the Nachash say to Adam? He said, look, he tried to seduce Adam by saying, you will be as God. You notice what is, you know, the idea is this. If the Nachash is a Sitra Achra, the Yetzer Hara, and he was external to man, Adam Rishon, right? So then what was he addressing himself to in Adam Rishon? I cannot tempt you to do something if you have no drive or need in that direction. You must have a need or a drive, and then I can say, look, do that, what you really want. I can tempt you why it's great. So the question is, if the Yetzirah was outside of man, in the Nachash, so what was he addressing himself to? The answer, he was addressing himself to that existential thing which Adam has without a Sitra Achra, and that is his need to be somebody. So what did the Nachash say to him? V'heyisim kilokim. What was the temptation? He addressed himself exactly to the taiva that Adam had, to be as God. What is that? Enoid Mavadoi in terms of Adam Rishon. Or rather, Yeshoid Mavadoi. Because a man has that automatically. And the Nachash was Yisrael Hara, was addressing himself to that taiva by saying, Be'yisim kelokim, and you will be as God. So Adam says, what? I'll be as God? And that is exactly what I want to be. That omnipotence. Because that's the greatest sense of self that a person has. And the Migdal Bovel, later on the Chumash has a whole parsha with the Tower of Babel, right? Why is that put? One of the ideas is because that is a universal conflict of man. Man warring with God. That is the universal conflict of man. Therefore, Migdal Bovel illustrates that. What the real universal conflict of man is, which is expresses itself, of course, in a psychological way. And it's interesting to note that the word go'o, Gaiva comes from the root Gimel Aleph Hey, and Go'o means to swell. It's like bread, when bread swells. When bread swells, what is it mostly? Hot air. Gaiva is nothing more than a distortion of the real self. When you think you're somebody, you're nothing. That's why we call it Gaiva, because the word Go'o means to swell, to be full of hot air. It means the substance is only the yeast, the bread, and it gets full of hot air, so it rises. A person's a Bhagaiva is literally full of hot air, because what he truly is nothing. That's why Gaiva comes from the root Go'o. Hold up. Now, where we see this, that the Torah brings this beautifully down, the essential conflict of man. We see it in Ekev, Parashas Ekev by Sheni. It says, Hishomelecho, watch yourself. I'll read it in English. Lest you forget the Lord your God. What does forgetting God mean? Not to observe the mitzvahs. Why? What are you going to do that's going to make you forget God? Which we know means what? Yeshig mevadai. Therefore you don't do the mitzvahs because the mitzvahs tell you ainad mevadai. So it says, pentoichal visavoto, lest you eat and be satisfied. What is that? Express your will. Ubotam toivim tivne v'yashofto, and you're going to build beautiful houses and you'll live in it. That's doing what? The productivity of man. Ubechocho v'tzuricho yirbun, and you'll multiply bakar and tzoin, herd, possessions. Look at all the four ways. The kesev v'zohov yabeloch, and you'll want more money. That is the four ways which a man achieves a sense of self. If you do that, what will happen? V'rom levavecho, your heart will wax great. You're going to think you're somebody. And what's going to happen as a result? You're going to say, what are you going to say in your heart when it grows mighty and hoary? My strength has achieved all this. I am really a somebody. And I am the one who did this because I am somebody. So the Torah tells you how, what you're supposed to do to get those feelings. Guard yourself. And you're going to say, kuch v'yotzim yodi. And what's going to happen when you say Kuch V'yotzim Yodi? You'll forget the Ribbono Shel'Olam, which is Einad Mavadoi, and you're going to say Yeshad Mavadoi, right? And you won't do the mitzvahs. The Torah tells you actually how a man achieves a sense of self. If you have time, look at it. How achieve a sense of self, and what will happen? You achieve a sense of self, that is the essential conflict. You're going to achieve the sense of self. You'll forget the Ribbono Shel'Olam, which is you're going to declare Yeshay Bavadoi, and you won't do the mitzvahs. You merely have to look into the Torah. The Torah tells you the whole psychological process of man and the fundamental conflicts of man. And by a king, it says further, by a king, Verum Levovoi, and his heart will grow if he marbas Nechosim and so on, and Noshim and so on, Al Echov. The king achieves Gaiva in superiority. Not only does he feel a sense of self, but he feels a sense of self on his brothers because he is the king. So the king has to watch not only for a sense of self, but a sense of arrogance also. But we see that the Torah itself says how we develop these kind of feelings. We don't have enough time now to go and answer the 12 questions that I had asked at the beginning of the shiur. So therefore, next week what I will do is sort of give a review to sum up the entire idea of the Hashkofa principles as manifested in psychological phenomena, and also then try to answer the 12 questions that I had previously mentioned.